Howdy, my friends out there. It's your good friend Dan on the Olympic Peninsula. That's Washington State. It's June the 27th. It's almost 8 p.m. here, June the 27th, 2026. And I'm going to be changing up the format periodically on this podcast. I don't know that I need to always be doing my crappy keyboard work, and, you know, sometimes it's better just to have a talk. So I came across a YouTube video that dealt with the wildfires in Utah right now. And the actual person on there, a Politico, I think it was the governor or something, was talking about these particular wildfires and talking specifically about the fact that the trees in the forests were behaving like Roman candles. So, you know, and I'm sorry about that, my throat's a little dry. Dane Wigington has used that term in the past. Now, of course, the guy in the news article, whatever, CBS News video, he doesn't talk about geoengineering. He doesn't talk about the fact that there's particulates, material in the trees, just like it's everywhere now. And it's not just the microplastics. There are particles of this nanoscale aluminum, if you believe the work that Dane Wigington has done, in everything to include these trees. So they're not just that they're dried out and they still have plenty of pitch because they're flash dying, so the pitch is still there. It's not just that, but they also contain these metals that will change the dynamics. I mean, in some ways, these trees behave like a thermite candle. They can become super hot. And this would explain and allow you to avoid some of the woo-woo stories recently about energy weapons triggering these fires. If these trees have absorbed a great deal of this nanoscale aluminum, then yeah, the trees themselves would be extraordinarily hot when they burned, and it would be difficult to control a forest fire like that. So let's talk about where we could be at, because I, for one, don't think we need to scare each other, but I remember in 2020, people talking about the monkey herpes, aka the COVID, and they would quote all kinds of random bullshit. And then there was the Chris Martinson guy talking about little propellers allowing them to go up your pipe, up to your toilet. There were a lot of people spreading fear in March and April of 2020. Not enough people were stepping back and asking questions. Me, for one, I remember the emergency Washington National Guard hospital opening near Harborview, and it was up for a couple weeks. And then there was the BLM Antifa nonsense in my neighborhood, and it more or less proved to me that if there had been a pandemic, then the Seattle Police Department wouldn't have had their bicycle cops pretending to be Antifa carrying Glocks and making sure the marchers could shut down 12th Avenue. Again, if you know, you know. But they said, trust the experts, you have to listen to the experts. I will tell you explicitly, I don't know if there's anybody out there you can trust 100% when it comes to the issue of A, what's going on in the environment, or B, what the real truth is about geoengineering. I don't think there's anybody out there. I think Dane Wigington is as good as you're going to get when it comes to geoengineering, and I, for one, cringe sometimes when he starts talking about certain things, because I think it takes away from his message. I also am a little concerned about his strategies that he thinks are smart. I don't know that they're smart at this point in time. I don't know. But if you're going to research the topic of geoengineering, there is no better resource. He is probably the only decent resource, which means that if he's a sheepdog, and that's, again, a term that some of my listeners already know, but if he's a sheepdog, then you would already know this. So I don't know. If this is the best case scenario that we've talked about in the past, then this is just about economics and societal collapse, and it will be ugly and messy, and it still doesn't explain why they've been geoengineering. But it's not the end of the world or even close to it. It's just crazy like maybe 100 years of crazy, economic crazy, societal crazy, likely a couple big wars. Doesn't mean everything gets destroyed, but it would probably be 100 years before things kind of reset again, if it's that. If it is environmental as well, then it really is, fundamentally, if it's environmental as well, then it really is something that could be a lot worse. And I'd like to talk about one particular scenario that we could be in alignment with. I do not want to talk about Venus syndrome because, to me, it's a subject you can research. And Venus syndrome is so completely horrific that even talking about it means that basically we've given up. However, a lot of people who research this subject, especially when it comes to the rapid, discontinuous, non-linear climate shift scenario, where multiple tipping points get crossed, not just one. We're talking about the clouds tipping point. We're talking about the collapse of the permafrost, which means ultimately a lot of organic material is going to convert to gas. Some of it frozen underneath the Arctic Ocean. Some of it not converted yet because this really is just piles and piles of shit going back millions of years across the Arctic Circle. There are many tipping points that we probably already crossed. And that would mean that wherever we're headed, we're going there. The slightly less worse, plausibly survivable scenario is something called hothouse Earth. And hothouse Earth, life has been there before. In fact, you could argue, paleontologists would probably argue that life has been there for most of life's history. It's been warmer, not cooler. That doesn't mean for humans. You know, for human beings, we've gotten kind of a cooler, sometimes way too cool, right? But we've had kind of a cooler period. And the last 11,000 years have been quite nice. But for most of Earth's history, if you believe what they tell you, and that's a big if, things have actually been a lot warmer than they are right now. So if we do end up in hothouse Earth, it is an environment within which life can exist. And then the question is, can we? A lot of the scenarios that I have come across would tell you the following. These fires we've had are not going to get better for a long time. You'll have fires, and then you'll have repair, and then you'll have fires again. And this could go on for a long time, especially around the Arctic Circle. There is a lot of stored fuel, if I can call it that, around the Arctic Circle. And that fuel is uncorked. It's becoming uncorked. So the heat waves will probably be as bad or worse in that scenario of hothouse Earth. As we move towards it, we're going to experience heat waves that are going to be closer to the normal for where we're going to end up. It's reasonable, given the period of history within which we developed agriculture, starting roughly 10 to 11,000 years ago, it is reasonable to presume that our current agricultural methods, even with technology, are not going to keep up with the changes in the climate, which is another way of saying that there's going to be a massive threat on a basic level to the food supply. I think in all likelihood, we are on the verge of probably a multi-year famine. And brothers and sisters, in my opinion, the issue of the Iran war could very much be a kind of cover story for what's something they already knew was coming. I'm sorry. I know that you know, you want to believe these are organic things, and maybe they are. But the great thing about the Iran conflict is it allows the people in charge to provide a culprit for why the food production's crashing. Well, it's because of the fertilizer. It's because of Iran. It's a relatively simple explanation, and it's a lesser catastrophe. So I would ask you to be a little bit skeptical of the entire story. It doesn't mean it's not going on or happening, but I will tell you the Iran war is more interesting in many ways than the Ukraine war, because it really did come down to a kind of bomb and missile war. And bomb and missile wars are just only a few degrees of insurance costs removed from almost a simulation. I don't want to be crass, but in reality, the bomb missile war, the war of jets and missiles, is a relatively easier war to fake than a full-on metal-on-metal type war that supposedly is happening in Ukraine. So let's just keep it simple. The petrodollar is probably dead. Food prices are going to go up in the best-case scenario. And I think there was going to be a famine in the best-case scenario anyways, because the way we produce food is crashing. But the bottom line is, in the worst case, which is what we're talking about, food is going to become very scarce at any price. And it's just something that I don't know what you can do about it. I would love to tell you that if you live in a city, you can grow sprouts in your bathroom. I remember these edgelords a few years ago telling people this shit on Twitter. Oh, you can just grow sprouts in your bathroom. Listen, folks, cities are not good places to grow crops. The soil in most cases is toxic. Let's just pull that Band-Aid off. In the case of places like Seattle, you don't know what World War II factory was churning out stuff. Let's just keep it simple, okay? But even if you do a kind of improved hydroponics, you're going to need electricity technology. You're going to need security. And I am not entirely convinced that you're going to reach a scale where you can produce anything remotely like excess. But maybe you will. Maybe you've got it all figured out. I tell you the truth, though, I think the cities are going to have a few decades of withering down. Let's put it that way. Like, if your city currently has 250,000 people, don't be surprised if in 10 or 15 years it's 25,000 people. And I don't really care how you feel about that. Neither does nature. And if this is about God's plan, well, really neither does God. It's the plan. Sorry. Amidst the flood, the Lord can save you, but that doesn't mean the flood doesn't happen. You see what I'm getting at? It's not like you get to say, well, gee, Lord, don't have a flood. No, you can build it. You can build a boat, Noah. There's going to be a flood. Let's just get that out of the way. The transitional period to hothouse Earth, which would be the next equilibrium state, could last at least decades. It could last centuries. And that means decades to centuries of really, really extreme weather, and which means, again, famine. But it also means for the next couple decades, and I think we've already seen the opening rounds, but I think a lot of it's been kind of fake and synthetic. So forgive me if I don't want to say it point at the Ukraine conflict or at Iran, but what is about to come, which is going to be quite real, if we want to use the term Grinken time, as Grinken time arrives, the social chaos is going to be off the hook, especially if we get hit by a multi-year famine, which I think is likely. It's going to take a technological leap that we haven't reached yet to scale up a food system that's going to deal with what's about to happen, because I think you're going to move a lot of your food production underground. I think the weather could be so extreme that it will scour the earth in a lot of places. And whatever topsoil you think you have, well, it's going to be gone. It's going to be washed away by floods and super tornadoes and, you know, derechos with 400-mile-per-hour winds. Did you say 400-mile? Let's say 500. We don't really know. But that transition is discontinuous. Okay, think of a volcano going off. That's not a smooth process. Okay, the one moment before it was fine, well, kind of fine. It probably had a lava dome. You probably had a geologist from the UW paying you a visit, Mr. Truman. But one moment it's fine, in a sense, and the next moment it's Mount St. Helens is exploding. The same thing applies to major climatic shifts. Now, it doesn't happen instantaneously, not in human terms. But in geological terms, this is going to happen so fast, it's going to knock people's teeth out, which means there's going to be a lot of chaos, social chaos. There's probably going to be a World War III, assuming the people in charge are the people that are in charge. Folks, we're here. This is where we ended up. If we want to turn this into a philosophical conversation about whether this is the best of all possible worlds, who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but we are where we're at, and the people in charge right now look crazy to me. And I don't mean the people we're supposed to look at. I don't mean the columns of smoke like Papa Blump. I mean through implication and through derivation, the people who are pulling the strings, they seem crazy to me. I think that they plan on most of us just dying. And that they're based, and maybe that's not crazy, maybe a better term is sociopathic. They expect most of us to just die, okay? And so whatever happens next, no matter how severe the transition is, they expect most of us just to get wiped out. They also need to be someplace where they could do a lot better than everyone else. And once again, folks, there is one place on Earth that's going to be near perfect if you've got technology. That's the big if. If you have technology and you have preparation and you've been able to build these bunkers for decades, there is only one place on Earth that will sort of weather the storm in a sense, and that's Antarctica, specifically the mountain ranges. If you've got the technology and you can build bunkers into those mountain ranges, you have access to resources, according to Admiral Byrd, a lot more than just, you know, water, or I should say ice. But you would have access to massive underground liquid water, which they know of. There's all sorts of resources down there if you have technology. And so you set up some reactors, you build up the energy resources and technology to keep the reactors going for maybe 1,000 years. You set up the tech to produce your own food, probably hydroponically, and you live down there. And it sounds crazy, folks, but other than the tip of South America, which will be crazy because it won't be far enough south, maybe New Zealand, you know, parts of Australia, Tasmania, maybe parts of South Africa. I mean, there's a lot of maybes in all this. It depends upon how far south you are. The Northern Hemisphere is going to be kind of disgusting in a lot of ways for a few decades because you're talking about a lot of shit unfreezing. And so I don't know that you're going to want to live above the Arctic Circle probably for another 50 to 100 years. But who knows? Maybe this transition will happen faster. I would argue, as a rule, the faster it happens, the more catastrophic it's going to be from our perspective. So yeah, no matter how long this lasts, there's going to be famine, there's going to be social chaos. If we're headed towards hothouse Earth, okay, which is a theoretically survivable place for humans to exist. I just mentioned some geography. Nobody's going to be living a normal life between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, which is another way of saying if we're moving towards hothouse Earth, these are places where everyday people are going to have to move. I mean, yeah, maybe you could live in bunkers underground. Maybe you could live in subsurface ocean habitats. But other than certain types of technology being applied and wearing a spacesuit, the overall temperature there will be so hot that without some type of protective gear, you won't live more than 30 to 40 minutes. It'll simply be too hot. It will be a little tiny taste of not so much Venus, but where Venus, a taste of where we would be headed if we didn't stop at hothouse Earth, and frankly worse. So yeah. Between Capricorn, Cancer and Capricorn, people have to move. Now, here's the magic question. Has that already been happening? And has it been covered up as other types of emigration? I don't know. I just want to reiterate this point. The weather is going to be crazy. If this is the beginning of a transitional period, the weather is going to be crazy. But what makes it worse is that, according to Dane Wigington, they've been geoengineering. And I think he's probably right. I don't know that I can prove it, but I do believe him when he's talking about it. I think that subject is a subject on which he has a great deal of knowledge. And it does seem pretty obvious to me that something's going on. But the bottom line is, at some point, it simply stops working or stops happening, which is to say that it either its effectiveness reaches zero, and we could be close to that point, or society collapses, and frankly, there's just not the resources to keep it going. That type of program requires a lot of resources, especially given that it's a black ops program. It's a program that is happening below the radar. You've got to pay off a lot of people to make a program like that work. During social collapse, I don't think you keep it working. So the question is, what happens when it stops working? According to Dane Wigington, they have been dumping energy, excess energy, into the oceans, treating the oceans like a capacitor. Well, what do capacitors eventually do? They discharge. And one of those questions, and I don't know if people have really thought about it on any level yet, but one of those questions that's occurred to me is, what if the oceans lost like 5 to 10% of their mass over a period of a year or two? And you say, well, Dan, you're talking about evaporation. Yeah, imagine 5 to 10% of the mass of all the oceans on Earth converted to water vapor over a period of a year to 18 months. I think you could ask a climatologist what that might mean. To me, it could mean the opposite of hothouse Earth. It could mean a flash ice age. And also, worst case, something almost as bad as Venus syndrome, and that's snowball Earth, which means you stay locked. It's such a bad ice age. You stay locked in that condition for millions of years. And humans are not going to thrive if everything is frozen, just as they won't thrive if everything melts. So, I don't know. If we're moving towards hothouse Earth, you probably shouldn't live below 300 feet sea level. I mean, I'd say 100 feet, below 100 feet above sea level. So like, I'd say conservatively, you should live currently 300 feet above sea level. Worst case scenario, between geologic rebound and tides themselves shifting and weather events and all the ice in Greenland that's on the ground, you know, land-based ice. The sea-based ice is not the issue. It's already creating displacement. In theory, when you melt sea-based ice, the water level should go down a little. It's the land-based ice that's the issue. It's Greenland, it's Antarctica, and frankly, it's all these mountain ranges that are, you know, a lot of the glaciers in these mountain ranges are going away. That's going to raise the sea level. And depending upon estimates, it seems like it's between 50 feet to 300 feet, worst case. So I would say, just say, as a rule of thumb, you're not going to want to live below 300 feet, current sea level, you know, below, above it. So if you're above 300 feet sea level, you're probably okay. If you're below 300 feet above sea level, then you probably need to move higher. I don't know. I think that humans could theoretically survive, could survive in hothouse Earth, but the chaos we're going to go through is going to be pretty brutal. You know, one thing that Dane Wigington has mentioned about the geoengineering is that part of the system, because it's a big system, it's not just the sprain, part of the system are these atmospheric heaters like HARP. And one of the things he's mentioned in the past is that these systems are capable of producing seismic effects. In theory, these systems are capable of generating an earthquake. So, again, when you think about the recent news, and I don't just mean Venezuela, when you think about all of the weird geological events that have occurred in the recent news last year, and maybe a lot of stuff we're not even hearing about, it's possible that one of the side effects of late-stage geoengineering is you're overclocking, in a sense, some of this technology, and you're producing side effects that are probably not good, which includes things like earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Another thing to keep in mind on the subject of rapid heating, rapid transition, is that there are a lot of scientists who openly discuss using nuclear weapons to cool the Earth. And we've discussed that on this podcast before. Dane Wigington has discussed this a great deal. Is it likely to be a good strategy? Probably not. But when you consider the madness of the current situation and where the chips are on the table in terms of the players and the chips and the pieces and the puzzles, it's hard to see how we avoid it. I don't know. I want to close out this podcast by saying the following that I've said before. We're not talking about something for which blame is useful. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people who made decisions. If you ask me, the most toxic environmental event of the last century has been the global adoption of central banks and the amount of debt we produce, because all of that debt has consequences. And one of the consequences has been this overproduction, overutilization, this kind of landfill society. In my humble opinion, in a truly free society, that pretty much mostly would not have happened. But when you've got the central banks and the armies and lots of prisons, you can do all kinds of creepy shit. We are where we are. You know, one of the things that troubles me about the Greta Thunbergs and the Al Gores of the world is they spend a lot of time blamestorming. Other than just making the issue look like a joke, they spend a lot of time pointing blame. And in general, the blame gets pointed at just ordinary people. Ordinary people driving cars, ordinary people eating cheeseburgers. And historically, that is the common pattern. If something goes awry, if something fails in society, blame the poor. Or more specifically, more accurately, blame the weakest in society. You know, if Seattle has problems, it's because of the homeless people. That's absolutely the case, right? I mean, it's probably not the whole truth. It's probably not even close to the truth, but it's a very convenient description. If the forests are dying in California, it's the Beatles. The Beatles have always been there. The Beatles are a wrecking crew. The Beatles come in when the trees are, to quote the guy in the video I hope you guys watch, dying inside. The trees are already dying inside. They are dead. Then the Beatles show up. That's the logic of it. The worst thing we could do if we want a chance in hell, individually, as communities, and as a species, would be to descend into blame storming. But the fact is, after 2020, I have no doubt that that's what will happen. And the right will blame the left, and the left will blame the right, and the Republicans will blame Democrats, and vice versa. And we'll probably even have people put on trial, and we'll probably even toss people in prison. And some of these people might deserve it. But at the end of the day, what we really need to do is figure out how to survive this. And more violence and more coercion and more of the same, to be specific, more of the same, okay, is not gonna help us. We've been applying the same formula to major social issues my whole life, really, going back thousands of years. And in general, it involves government force. And if we do that again, I think this will fail. If we attempt to adopt a kind of voluntary perspective on this and build a coalition of people who want to fix the problem, then I think we have a chance. And in any case, in any event, ordinary people organizing on their own have all the power they need to start thinking about this. Understand, it's not just about the temperature. The transitional period, which could last the rest of your lifetime and your kid's lifetime, the transitional period is going to involve a lot of chaotic weather. And that weather could make it almost impossible to grow food the way we currently do. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it can't be done the way we currently do it. So there are things people can think about and how they would deal with that. But at this point, trying to point fingers and figure out who we can blame, that's not useful. Now, do I think that the powers that be want us to do that? Hell yeah. And if we get close to the end, are they going to fuel that? Hell yeah. Hell yeah. They got their little Pol Pots in every city that they need to do this with. They can just do it. They'll turn a switch. Some places it'll be the conservative version. Some places it'll be the quote-unquote liberal version. But yeah, they'll throw a switch and they'll turn us on each other. Don't get suckered by it. You know, you have a choice if you want to live or die, if you want to survive. That is your choice. It is a choice if you want to participate in a period of chaos where people blame each other for the daggers falling from the sky, or you can figure out a way to shelter from that. But you can't do both. Anyways, it is June the 27th, 2026, and I hope you guys have a great rest of your Saturday night.